1420 AM, W248 DE,
Wisconsin Rapids,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Special Report. A 7.4 earthquake shakes Taiwan, damaging buildings and causing a small tsunami that washed ashore on Japanese islands. Reporter Gavin Blair in Tokyo.
This was on the east coast of Taiwan. There are reports on the eastern side of the island of damage to buildings, but no reports yet of injuries, though it is very early days, and some of these isolated areas may not have been reached yet.
Jonathan Tytel with the U.S. Geological Survey.
The shake intensity was very high.
A five-story building in lightly populated Hualien appeared heavily damaged, collapsing its first floor and leaving the rest leaning at a 45-degree angle. Tytel says the depth of the quake was shallow.
With liquefaction, you have just giant ponds of water appearing in people's neighborhoods, on people's streets, because the water table is basically being shaken loose.
The Pacific New Tsunami Warning Center says the tsunami threat has largely passed. CBS News Special Report. I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
The Kitchen's Open on WFHR, a feature within the morning show every Monday at 9. Join me, Melissa Kay, and my guests to learn about food-related topics that will interest and entertain. This is election night coverage on WFHR. I'm Melissa Kay. Here's what you need to know. According to AP News, the uninstructed vote by Democrats in Wisconsin has now topped 34,000. Critics of Biden's support in the war in Gaza said they wanted to pick up 20,000 votes, the same number Biden beat Trump by in Wisconsin in 2020. With 62% of the votes counted in the state, they've already exceeded that number by over 14,000 votes. Election results are still coming in for Wood County. While these results are still unofficial, I'll list off those who have received the most votes in each race. Wood County Supervisor District 1, Wayne Schultz. For the Town of Saratoga Board Supervisor, Carl Greenaway received the most votes, with Joshua McDonald following behind. The top three for the Village of Trustee in Auburndale, Deb Stofflett, Terry Martin, and David Classy. The first numbers for Port Edwards Village Trustees are out. Lon Radke has 374 votes, Rick Hess 304, and Eric Saylor 299. Eric Hummel received the least votes with 164. Nacoosa incumbent mayor Daniel Carlson received the most votes, and Wisconsin Rapids candidate for mayor Matt Zacher received the most votes. The top three running for alderperson in Pittsville, Mark Darr, Brian Kistner, and Dennis Todd. Alderperson District 1 in Marshfield is Michael J. Ferrier. Alderperson District 3 in Marshfield is Matthew Sampson. Wisconsin Rapids Alderperson District 4, Jeff Penscover, and District 8, Madeline Palmquist. Alderperson District 7 in Marshfield is Brian Giles. We're still waiting on the final district for the Wisconsin Rapids School Board to report. Right now, the top three with the most votes are Christopher Inda, Elizabeth St. Myers, and John Benbow. We're still watching for election results to come in out of Portage County and Adams County. Stay tuned for another update as results continue to come in. And that's what you need to know. I'm Melissa Kay, WFHR News.
Attention landowners. Got big plans for your land? Tackle all your spring projects with a powerful John Deere machine. And now with 0% APR for 72 months on select compact tractors, riding lawnmowers, and Gator utility vehicles, plus up to $2,000 off select compact tractors. It's never been easier to get in the sea. Offer available April 1st through 30th. Visit johndeere.com to find your local dealer. For complete finance details, please call toll-free 1-800-226-8903.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Easter morning. Oh, well, Donald Trump had a little fit. 71 social media posts on his Truth Social. One of them did reference Easter. Simply posted Happy Easter. The rest of them, wow, the crazy, oh my goodness, the crazy. One of them, he actually claimed that he was the chosen one, sent by God and blessed by God. You know, it's his divine right to be president. The rest of it was just whining, complaining. What do you expect? You know, you're taking his his fits of anger out on, you know, Jack Smith and all of the people that he believes have slighted him, he believes have done him wrong. Yeah, yeah, crazy, crazy stuff. And, oh, Tommy Tuberville had a good Easter message as well. He said that Democrats were a satanic cult. So that was his Easter message. And would you expect nothing else from the dumbest guy in the U.S. Senate? But this is the thing. I remember, you know, and I said this on the program yesterday, that as I'm watching all these truth posts come out, and I'm laughing because at this point it's comical that you have a guy who is potentially the next president of the United States having a temper tantrum like a child in public in all caps. Fortunately, on a social media platform that very few people use and is now the front and center, the heart of a new pump and dump. Because we find out on Monday, shocker of all shockers, that the guy who, the Mr. Art of the Deal, you know, the very best deal guy, not such a good deal. In fact, pretty crummy deal. In fact, really, really bad. And again, we've known this from the vodka to the Trump University to the steaks to the airlines to every other con and grift that he could possibly imagine to fleece people out of money and then, you know, walk away holding, letting everyone else hold the bag. Are you surprised that Truth Social is the next in a line of, I'm sure, what will be not the last, but a line of cons? Because we find out on Monday that his social media company lost $58 million in 2023. And here's the kicker. This is the part. You go, well, you know, had a lot of expenses. They only brought in $4.1 million in revenue in 2023. So they, again, Mr. Art of the Deal, Mr. I Know Business, I'm the best, I'm the greatest businessman, everyone loves my business. If you're running a business and you're spending, what, $62 million and only bringing in four, I think there's a problem. There is a massive disconnect of where we are, and which is why I think the stories so far have been, congratulations, you know, the flock probably fleeced again. All of those cultists who said, oh, we're going to invest in Truth Social, they're probably going to lose their you-know-whats. Because I think every person that I've talked to who knows anything about Wall Street or investing looks at this company and goes, how people bought into this beyond them? Expect this stock to plunge. In fact, the accounting firm, this is the part that just blows my mind. The accounting firm that Trump uses for his media company is going, don't think you're going to make it. I think we're, again, Mr. Bankruptcy, maybe going to bankrupt another company. And you go, for what aim? Well, clearly to try and line his pockets. Clearly to try and, well, do more of what he does really well. Fleecing the faithful. And I ask myself, could this be the Waterloo? Could this be the final straw where people go, no, we thought Truth Social was making all this money. We thought they had a lot of users. They don't. Turns out everything is in the toilet. Users are down, losing money. It's again, I'm not a Wall Street investor, but I am smart enough to go, I don't know that I want to buy into a sinking ship. The Titanic of social media, right here. Now, one of the arguments that I read that you have to be concerned about, and this is a political year, and you have to talk about the political ramifications of, you now have Trump who has this what is going to be a failing company. The only way this company turns around is if what we're seeing right before our very eyes is that this is a giant bribery scheme. And the argument of, hey, you know, this could be, if he becomes president and is commander in chief, this could, quite frankly, give foreign or even domestic interests a way to pressure Trump. a way to sway his views to one way or another. Hey, you know, I'll bail out your company if you, you know, whatever. And you have to wonder, is this what you want? Now, I've been saying for a long time, I think Trump, all of his businesses are set up to do one thing, and that's make Trump a whole bunch of money. Not you, not me, not the good of the public, none of those high-minded community kind of charter ideas of the beginning of the country. But hey, more for him, and leave everyone holding the bag. Remember, it's a guy who bankrupted a casino, a place where generally you could print money. I'm looking at this, and I got a question. When will we wake up? Now, here's where my faith is. The Securities and Exchange Commission is watching. So, you know, this could be, and I ran this past a red hat who lost his mind. I said, you know, what do you think if it turns out to be just they threw this out here in the hopes of cashing in on the IPO and letting it tank? Could you see another criminal indictment coming? Could you see the SEC going after him for securities fraud, for whatever? Because clearly, there's nothing here. And if Trump were to leave that platform, it would collapse entirely. The only reason that most people tune into it, the only reason that I look at it is I want to see what kind of insanity Trump is going to relay. I want to see when he has a 71 tweet or 71 truth day or 71 post day, what kind of insanity is next? Because as I said at the beginning, I'm watching all of this flurry of crazy coming out going, wonder what's coming out tomorrow. I wonder what bad news. Is there an indictment that I don't know about? Is there bad news somewhere that he just got, knows is coming, and now needs to provide ground cover? Because that's what this is. And generally our media, the lapdogs there follow right along. Oh, he said crazy stuff. Let's talk about crazy stuff. And not talk about the fact that, bad news. This very different. So when we come back, I'm going to spend a little time figuring out, you know, how is this going to play out? Get some questions answered on where we should be looking, what it is I might be missing, and, any accountability. So when we come back, Bartlett Collins Naylor is going to be here from Public Citizen to share some thoughts on just how what we don't know. Maybe answer some of my questions and help me figure out, could we see another indictment? Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So I'll tell you, on Easter, I spent the day watching, among other things, you know, you had your family things. But, you know, on Truth Social, I'm watching Trump just lose his mind on, you know, as we talked about, lose his mind on the truths there. 71 of them. Called himself the chosen one. Lots of stuff. Lots of, you know, sent me the message that, you know, something bad was going to happen on Monday. And, well, we find on Monday that Truth Social lost $58 million in 2023 and just had $4.1 million in revenue. Now, this thing, when they did this IPO thing, when they opened it up for all of the flock to come to, something like $7 billion they got on a company that doesn't appear to be worth, I don't know, 7 cents. That's why I've asked Bartlett Collins to come talk with us. Barton Collins Naylor is an expert on corporate governance, financial markets, and shareholder policy rights. He's a financial policy advocate over at Public Citizen, citizen.org, their website. Bartlett, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for having me.
So have I laid this out right? The story I'm getting, we're now finding out that the company that supposedly is worth $7 billion gave Trump a almost $4 billion windfall, only made $4.1 million in revenue last year while losing $58 million?
That's right. A company with those kind of revenue and profit slash loss numbers should be worth nothing. A point of clarification, when this company had its initial public offering, it's not that $8 billion went into the company or $5 billion went into the company. A number of millions of dollars of investor money went into the company. And at a certain price, if you were to say, well, if there's 10 shares and they're selling for $10 a share, that values the company at $100.
Right.
But if there's another 1,000 shares, that values the company at more, even though the money isn't there. So for example, on a cryptocurrency, if I have a token and I have 1 million tokens and I sell you one for a dollar and you sell it to your friend for $10, times the 1 million tokens, suddenly the market capitalization of that cryptocurrency is up into the billions when really only $11 has changed hands. So this $8 billion valuation is not a truckload of cash that has gone into the company. It's a far lower number. And it just happens that Trump has 60 or 58% of the shares. And were he to be able to unload it of people buying it, then technically that's what it would be worth. Although, as we can get into, anytime you sell, then the price is unlikely to, when there's a lot of selling pressure, the price is unlikely to be sustained at that higher level.
Well, of course. But, you know, it immediately when this happened, you know, it was my opinion that this was going to be the great con, because I don't know very many people on Truth Social. I don't see them competing at all with Twitter or even Gab for that matter. So the fact that this was going to happen and all this money was going to flow into these people buying these shares, as an outsider, as someone purely who's a spectator in what happens on Wall Street, my thought is, could this be the greatest con ever that Trump pulls off? Could this be a way for the Saudis or the Russian oligarchs or whomever to funnel money to Trump right before our very eyes to pay his legal bills and all the other stuff? Any of that ring a bell, ring with
well,
you?
I've had some wild thoughts that how many Americans are willing to pay $50 a share for something that's really worth nothing? And are they so generous as to basically do that? In other words, if you were to say, you know, this person is a great guy, I'm just going to send him a gift of $50. And this is a way to do that. Could the Saudis, could the Russians do that? I suppose they could. And you would say, well, there's reputational harm, but I think we're well beyond beyond the problem of reputational harm. That said, it just seems extraordinary. Let me jump in and say, this is the most shorted stock on Wall Street right now. And by that, I mean, these are people who are making bets that the company will go down. And with such a relatively thin market capitalization now compared to the, you know, giants like Apple and Google, that's saying something, that there are already people lined up betting that this stock will decline.
And I got to imagine Trump's got to be one of them. And how ironic that would be.
That would be ironic. I'm not sure that he's allowed to short his own stock, but That's a question that I'll have to research.
I wonder what the kids are doing. Because, you know, look, I look at this and I'm with you. When this first happened, I said, you know, working people may, because they believe in him. They bought the red hat. They got the T-shirt. They got the flags. They're buying the Bible. They're doing all this stuff that he's throwing out there because, well, they're in the cult. That this is one more of those things. And, you know, as I was thinking about it, because, you know, as this pops up, you know, could this, in my mind, could this be the last great con where people finally wake up and go, holy, you know what? There's literally nothing here.
I think that's right. So if my understanding of how the gravitational forces work on Wall Street, over the course of the next 2 or 3 months, this stock will decline basically to where it should be, which is nothing. So that when Trump's restricted period ends, there won't be much to sell. Now, as you know, the board could waive those restrictions on when he would start to sell. That wouldn't be a good sign either. But noticing that short selling, the stock is already down 20-some% today, suggests there is no floor. There is no basic level of Trump investors hungry to gobble this stock up at any price. Apparently, there is a limit, and the short selling presumably is having an impact on the decline in this price.
So let me ask you this, you know, from the IPO to this moment where it's clearly going down, and I agree with a lot of the commentators I've seen that this is going to tank further. What does he get out of this? I mean, did he make money off the original IPO? Is he going to be able to make the $4 billion that they claimed? You know, what tanking this does he get out of this? I guess
I don't think he's been able to put any money into his pocket yet. That is when he is allowed to sell his stock, and then that depends on the stock price. So that's months away, again, unless he gets a waiver from his board, which includes people that worked for him or he is the parent of.
So maybe, and you could dump this pig on someone else. So the question I then have when you look at this going, it, on paper, you know, given this report, and I'm sure more will come out, I look at this sentence of this Sam Bankman-Fried, who got 25 years for fraud. I'm kind of going, look, not a Wall Street guy, not a lawyer, but one guy gets thrown in jail for 25 years for fraud. Another guy's got a giant, you know, chocolate covered turd that, you know, trying to bank off on folks. What's the difference?
The difference, I think, is that Sam Bankman-Fried lied. He said that put your money in this exchange and we'll keep it there. And he, in fact, took $8 or more billion and shipped it over to his hedge fund where they made bets, or shipped it off to members of Congress in political contributions, or to Tom Brady and other sports figures. So he didn't tell the truth. In this case, Donald Trump is telling the truth. He says, I've got a business. It loses a lot of money. Now, please invest in it.
Okay. No, and I'm glad you clarified that, because that was a question that was banging around in my head. So this is just the Trump brand going, hey, this is what we do. Because clearly this is another in a long line of products and things that he's brought to the market that have, well, failed.
And one nice thing about a stock as overseen by the Securities and Exchange Commission is that they do have to be candid in their disclosure. So if he's going to sell you a degree from Trump University or a juicy steak from Trump Steak, he can embellish a good deal, but he can't really embellish, or the company can't embellish in their Securities and Exchange disclosures. And it is an enjoyable read. You know, one of our principal owners faces 91 indictments. That's part of the risk that you have to read about when you are investing in this, should you care to read these disclosures.
Now, I keep seeing that this is like the big meme stock. What does that mean?
I think that is a trope that comes from an experience with GameStop about 2 or so years ago, when a bunch of gamers decided that the storefront that sold video games might have a life despite other people saying, hey, you know, nobody buys anything from a bricks and mortar storefront anymore. You buy all these games online or they arrive in the mail. And so a number of people rallied around various social media forums and kept buying the stock. And it led to what's known as a short squeeze. When you are short, when you are betting something is going to decline in value, mechanically what happens is you borrow shares from somebody that owns them. Then you sell it at a price, I'll say $10 a share, because you figure that the price is going to go down to $2 a share, whereupon you buy it for $2 a share, you have the stock, and you give it back to the guy that lent it to you when it was selling for $10 a share. If, however, the stock goes from $10 to $15, you have to either pay some interest on that to make sure you're not going to run away, or you have to cover your short by buying it at $15 a share. And so once the stock kept going up, in this case, GameStop, with so many retail investors involved in it, it led to a short squeeze. And some people say that it was the little guy taking revenge on the big guys on Wall Street. And certainly some big guys on Wall Street did lose money.
Yeah, is there any possible that this becomes something in that world? Because I had someone try and explain it to me, and I'm, look, again, not a Wall Street guy, but that this could be like the Red Hat revenge. Like this could be the ground where they go, no, we're going to defend our guy. Even if it is a giant chocolate-covered turd, we're sticking with it.
Well, you'll have to have people, if at current prices, are willing to collectively spend $5 or $8 billion. And for context, those who are supportive of Trump, the candidate, are not making those contributions to his campaign. They're not in the billions of dollars. Those are in the millions of dollars. So if you truly believe in this candidate, you would imagine that you would invest with your political contribution. And so far, that's not even in the same order of magnitude as what the stock market valuation is. Though, again, as we discussed, market capitalization is a different figure than actual money invested.
Interesting. So as of this moment, as of we know right now, there's no Saudi prince coming in to come bail them out. There's none of that going on that we know of.
Not that I know of, but I think you, I, and a whole bunch of other people are on the alert for that, for another way of basically saying, you want to sell me a Beanie Baby? Here, I will give you an ungodly amount of money for it. I mean, Trump did try to sell NFTs, non-fungible tokens.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, he couldn't find enough fools to make him a multi-billion-dollar payday off that. Apparently, some people realize what thin air is.
But I do know a couple people who did. I mean, so there are, unfortunately, there are, well, what's that thing? There's a sucker born every minute? And Trump's figured out a way to get at least some of them to line his pockets.
It would appear.
Amazing stuff. But this is just, there's so much here. Is there anything I'm missing? Anything that you go, hey, you forgot something? Because this is, again, this is a world that I'm not, you know, in depth in. Is there something that maybe we're missing that I should be aware of as well?
Well, I was intrigued at some of the accounting that led this company that had less revenue in 2022 than it did in 2023 and yet reported a profit. So I'm a little concerned that accounting shenanigans, God forbid that would ever take place in a Trump business, that some accounting shenanigans might be at play. But again, I think that this company loses a lot of money on very little revenue, and an investor can't count on this company sustaining a $5 or $7 or $9 billion valuation.
Last question I've got for you, because you opened the door here with accounting potential irregularities. And I guess this is a look into your crystal ball. Do we expect maybe someone? Because it seems to me every time Trump gets involved in one of these, someone gets into legal trouble, generally not him, but someone gets thrown under the bus. Any prediction on how many or if there will be people who see, legal action?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think if you did have one of these nefarious investors coming to bail them out, that would be a problem. So, for example, even though some of these foreign funds, you could argue, are led by single individuals, some of them do have fiduciary responsibilities. So literally handing over a gift is something that that could be problematic, even in countries without a full-throated democracies.
Right.
And I would, again, laud the Securities and Exchange Commission and the regime under which this is happening. The reason a public company is generally so well regarded is that it has a universe of people watching it. Investors have money in it as a public company. A private company is obviously not subject to that same public scrutiny. Hence, a lot of the things that have gone on in the past with this person and the people that have gone to jail were not subjected to that public scrutiny.
Got it. Well, we'll see where this takes us. But Bartlett, I appreciate you taking some time for us, sharing your expertise. I'm sure this will come up again, so I'd love to have you back again as this continues down the road.
Thanks for your interest.
Thanks so much, Bartlett Collins Naylor, expert on corporate governance, financial markets, and shareholder rights there with the Financial Policy Advocate Group, Congress Watch. Public Citizen is where they're at, citizen.org, their website. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. Want to hear your thoughts. You throwing $50 in? Do you know any red hats who are going to the rescue? I want to hear it. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Right back. Thanks for tuning in to The Rick Smith Show. Be sure to follow us on Twitter @RickSmithShow, like us on Facebook, Instagram, and subscribe to our YouTube channel.
This is locally grown radio, WFHR. This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. A winter storm warning continues through tomorrow morning for 3 to 7 inches of snow. The snow showers could be heavy at times through the overnight and breezy, a low in the upper 20s. Windy for tomorrow, some gusts as high as 40 miles an hour. Additional snow showers with an inch or two likely. High upper 30s. Right now it's 33.
To everyone who can't get enough bacon, we're cooking up something savory for you at Culver's. If you thought our cook-to-order bacon deluxe couldn't get any better, wait until you get a taste of it with our new thick-cut bacon. It's savory, it's smoky, with just a hint of sweetness. Try it on the bacon deluxe, or add it to all your Culver's favorites. From Wisconsin with love, welcome to Delicious.
Culver's, 8th Street South, Wisconsin Rapids.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So California Governor Gavin Newsom had an interesting tweet the other day that caught my attention. Again, something we've talked about here on the program, but he tweeted out, here's your reminder that these three, he's talking about, President Obama, President Clinton, and President Biden, that these three have created 49 million out of the 51 million jobs in America since 1989, 96% of all jobs for the last 35 years, he writes, created by Democratic presidents. And you go, when you look at the numbers, completely accurate. And the fact that Republicans even whisper the Reagan question of, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago, is stunning, given the fact that 4 years ago, we had morgue trucks parked in front of hospitals. The economy was shut down. Supermarket shelves were barren. Unemployment near record highs. So why? Why is Biden not getting the credit, one would expect for cleaning up a massive mess from a once-in-a-100-year pandemic? Here to help answer part of that question, I've asked Zach Carter to come talk with us. Zach is a contributor over at Slate.com. He's also an author of the book, The Price of Peace, Money, Democracy, and the Life of John Maynard Keynes. Zachary, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
So what do you make of this? I mean, you know, I think I laid it out 4 years ago. The economy was shut down. We were locked in our homes. The shelves were barren. Things were not good. Not a period in time I would pine to return to. And yet here we are, near record unemployment. All of the communities that normally don't participate in good times doing really well. A stock market all-time highs, all this stuff. Why not even just a little credit?
It is remarkable how dour the sentiment is, given the strength of the economy by just about every metric that economists follow by historical standards. It's just very hard to find another economy that compares favorably to this one in the last 50 years. If you go back far enough, you can start pulling statistics here and there, but we haven't had the unemployment rate this low for this long, literally in over 50 years. It's below 4% now. It's been below 4% for several months, maybe even a year now. And despite the surge of inflation after the pandemic, wages are up. Even accounting for inflation, wages for the typical American worker are up, and they are up quite a bit for workers at the bottom end of the income ladder. I think the sort of harshest thing you can say about the Biden administration's recovery is that some of the best things they did just didn't continue. I mean, there are things like the child tax credit expansion that he did early in his administration, which was really helpful for a lot of families, but that expired. So, you know, would it be better if that had continued? I think the answer is yes. Is it bad that it happened? No. you have all these families who are just much better off than they would have been otherwise. And I think aside from the story of that the numbers tell, which is that we're living through one of the strongest economies in decades, you have a story about the government actually being effective here. The jobs created after the 2008 financial crisis were bad jobs. The majority of those jobs were poverty jobs. You did not see wage growth after the 2008 financial crisis. And that was, I think the Biden administration looked at the George W. Bush and Barack Obama administration's approach to that calamity and said, there's something to be learned from this. We can do better than that recovery. And in fact, if we don't do better than we did in that recovery, then American democracy might not make it. I look back at that recovery, recovery is such a it's a terrible word to use for that period. I mean, the Great Recession is a better description. The reason you had no wage growth is because the labor market was terrible. Yep. You had 10% unemployment. The unemployment hit 10% before the 2010 election and stayed there for 2 years. It didn't stay at 10%, it stayed above 9% for 2 years. The unemployment rate began falling during the Trump years, frankly, because we spent so much during the Trump years, and because Biden then spent $1.9 trillion out of the gate just to make sure that jobs were there. I mean, that money got spent on workers. It also got spent on corporations so they could hire workers. And then the money kept coming. I mean, there was another re-up with an infrastructure bill, and then another re-up with the CHIPS Act to supply basically subsidies for companies to build microchip factories in the United States. And then with the Inflation Reduction Act, which is kind of a cute name, but it's basically a manufacturing bill for green manufacturing, where there's a ton of subsidies being paid to companies if they will build factories here in the United States. And that's all happening. So
why don't we hear that? I mean, this is the part. You know, why aren't we hearing all of this good news? I mean, we talk about it here on the program all the time. I keep saying, look, an industrial policy, yes, please. Been begging for that for decades. The idea of the jobs that are created out of the money that we invest in infrastructure and bringing back manufacturing and all this other stuff should be good union jobs that people can live on. More of that, please. How come we're not hearing enough of that?
I think there are two complementary problems here. The first is that this type of policy that the Biden administration pursues is offensive to a certain brand of economist who's really steeped in the kind of Econ 101, supply and demand naturally meet their equilibrium stuff that everybody learns in their
You mean the people who got us into the mess that we're in? Because, you know, the economy was not great before the pandemic. The fact that we're inching up a little bit is good, but still not great. I mean, we're still decades behind where we should have been had it not been for the Reagan era bad policies and what Clinton continued. So for me, you know, good, things are getting better. That's fabulous. But we're decades behind what my grandparents' generation were able to do.
There is an enormous adjustment that has to be made. And I think to some extent, to a greater extent than I expected, the Biden administration has shown a willingness to make that that adjustment. I mean, I think the belief that manufacturing jobs aren't just going to pop up or that it's good that they disappear because better jobs will take their place. I mean, that clearly just hasn't been shown to be true. And I think that was part of the unrest that led to Trump being elected in 2016. These things are all multifaceted and have different causes. But I think that's clearly part of the story here. And I think the Biden administration wanted to learn from that and say, okay, well, that's not a way to run an economy. And they've done, I think, an admirable job. But I do think that this insistence on believing the things that people are taught in Econ 101, which, by the way, to be fair to economists, the rest of the economics profession is about unlearning Econ 101 and explaining why that stuff isn't true. But it often doesn't make its way into policy. I think a lot of economists who were upset about the amount of spending that was going on and then became even more upset about the attempt to sort of interfere with the natural flow of international free trade by explicitly creating domestic subsidies for companies that build things in the United States. I think that was very offensive to a certain kind of economist, and that economist typically occupies the center or the center right of the American ideological spectrum. And they have a lot of influence within the Democratic Party establishment. And I think a lot of these intuitions about Econ 101 are very dominant in a lot of the higher paid echelons of what remains of the American media landscape. So I think you ended up with a lot of the center saying, we don't believe in this policy. And then when inflation came, because we did see a rough run of inflation there for about a year, the progressive wing of the party didn't want to take credit for the labor market. Everybody was angry about inflation. So people said, well, I don't really have much to say about this right now.
You're right. I mean, and this is what Democrats do. It's the same thing they did with the Affordable Care Act. They run away from their accomplishments, whereas Republicans, even if it's bad, they are literally coming out, Zachary, and saying, are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? And there is nobody, I have found no one who goes, yeah, I was much better off 4 years ago. Well, that's not true. My son was happier because he was able to sit on the couch and watch TV, didn't have to go to school. There's one person. But for everybody else, 4 years ago was misery.
It was brutal. There was no guarantee that the economy was going to bounce back from that. I think also within the economics profession, there's this view that things just kind of work themselves out in a market economy. And when you have a big disaster like the COVID crash, if you just step back and wait for the economy to fix itself, it will. That's true.
Here's the thing. This is where maybe it does work itself out the way it's supposed to, in their view. The wealthy get wealthier because, as we've seen from the beginning of the pandemic until just recently, a study was out. The wealthier got 88% wealthier. Our billionaires got 88% wealthier over the pandemic, while the rest of us, I got $1,400 from Joe Biden. I think we got $600 from Trump, and I forget what the first one was. But I got a couple hundred bucks back, so I guess that evens out, right?
I don't know. I mean, I think even the wealthy can end up doing very badly if the government doesn't take action to support the economy. I mean, during the Great Depression, rich people did really well once the New Deal spending kicked in. It was actually really bad for, like, J.P. Morgan Chase made a lot more money after it wasn't called J.P. Morgan Chase then, but J.P. Morgan made a lot more money after it was broken up by the Glass-Steagall Act of 1933. That required those banks to split into smaller pieces. The bankers themselves were furious about this policy, but it turned out that splitting this company into multiple companies they had more business. And because there was more spending going into the economy, there were more deals to do. And so these companies ended up making a lot more money, even though the government was meddling in the economy and spending a lot of money on working people. So I think to some extent, it can be true that the rich do well when the economy suffers, but it can also just be the rich are padded from the suffering in a way that makes it seem like they're doing better than, you know, actually their fortunes are declining. In this particular recovery, I mean, one of the reasons rich people saw this extraordinary run up in their fortunes was because the government was backstopping financial losses. So we didn't have a banking crash and stock market valuations went through the roof. So if you don't participate in the stock market, you don't get to participate in those gains.
Right.
I think there was a concern, and I think it was justifiable, that if you let the bottom drop out of the financial wing of the economy during this, I mean, the COVID crash is different from the financial market crash of 2008, and that it wasn't a financial crash. It was a direct attack on industry itself. So if you add a financial crash to the industrial fallout that was occurring, you would have had a generational catastrophe. It already was, you know, the worst economic crash of our lifetimes, but you could have seen this thing drag out and get so much worse. And I think there's a progressive frustration that things seem to go well for rich people all the time. I mean, that's why they're rich. That's what it means to be rich, is things go well for you. And that everybody else has to sort of wait for a crisis to maybe see a little bit of progress. That is a reality. I understand the frustration. But in this particular crash, there was more money spent directly on working people than in 2008, than after 1992, than after any recession since the Great Depression.
I completely agree.
The $1,400 checks that you're talking about from Joe Biden, that was real, but the expansion of the child tax credit was even bigger. And the expansion of unemployment benefits that began under Trump and continued into 2022, I believe, was a really remarkable safety net for people. And, you know, you can talk to people who benefited from that. I mean, people who lost their jobs, who ended up making more money over the course of, you know, 9 or 10 months when there was no work to be found, who could have, you know, spend that time raising their kids, developing a new interest or a new hobby, just having a life where there might not have been one otherwise. And I think that was that spending was a product of a lesson learned from how not to do crisis recovery in 2008. And I think in general, it combined with the center's disbelief that the government can do things that are actually productive for people's lives, I think there is kind of a progressive nihilism that has been, or a nihilism that's been built into the progressive movement since the Obama years that says, you know, that just doesn't believe that the government will do things that benefit them, even when they are doing it, even when the government really is doing it. The Great Recession was so damaging for the psyche of American workers and American families that people just have a hard time believing that the system couldn't possibly be anything but always rigged against them.
Yeah, but you also throw into that, you know, 40 years of conservative messaging telling you government can't do anything and shouldn't do anything, and we need to leave everything to the invisible hand because it's the natural state of things. Yeah, that plays into this as well. So you have, look, I think you have a lot of people on both sides not believing that government action can make lives better, as where I believe it does.
You know, I think there's sort of a funny critique that has emerged about the Inflation Reduction Act, the CHIPS Act, I understand the critique from the centrist position. People say this is wasteful spending, this is interfering with international trade. I understand where they're coming from. I don't think that's a valid, I don't think it's true, but I understand what they're saying. There's sort of a left-wing version of that critique, which is this stuff is all corporate welfare. These are subsidies that are going to profitable corporations that don't need the money, and workers are being left out in the cold. And ultimately, they're saying the same thing. They're saying this is wasteful spending that doesn't benefit working people. And I think folks on the left and folks from the progressive movement and folks in the labor movement should take a real hard look at that argument and ask if it's really true that we're not seeing better jobs and better wages as a result of those investments that are being made.
See, as a labor person, and I can only speak for myself, I'm in favor of investing and building the future. But if a company's profitable, at the bargaining table, I want better wages, hours, and conditions. So if they're doing better, we should be doing better as well. I don't care how they got better, but there has to be that trickle down we were promised that for decades hasn't happened.
And I think tighter labor markets make it easier for unions to make that pitch or to land that.
And also, having laws in place that help with collective bargaining, which have been under assault for the last 40, 50 years.
And I think one of the best things that the Biden administration has done is appoint an extremely competent and knowledgeable team to the National Labor Relations Board.
Yeah, yeah. No, tell all my union friends, Jennifer Abruzzo is the reason you vote for Joe Biden. If you need no other reason, the woman who's there at the NLRB, that's the reason.
Look, people can vote for whoever they want to vote for. I think there are perfectly reasonable critiques of Joe Biden from many different ideological perspectives. But I don't find the argument that the economy is bad because he's rigged it against working people to be in any way compelling.
There you go.
I think that is 180 degrees the opposite of what has actually happened.
That is right on. And for me, he found Obama's comfortable shoes and actually walked a picket line. So for me, another step forward. But Zachary, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Great piece. You want to check out Zachary's work. Slate.com is where you can find that. His most recent piece, The U.S. Economy's Rebound Since COVID, is kind of incredible. Why doesn't anyone seem to realize this? Slate.com, Zachary Carter. Zach, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks so much for having me, Rick.
Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Should Biden be getting more credit for what I think is kind of amazing? Let me know. I want to hear. rick@therickSmithShow.com. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1917. That was the day that Montana Republican Jeanette Rankin was sworn in as the first ever woman elected to the U.S. Congress. Her mother was a school teacher, and her father was a rancher. On her victory, Representative Rankin said, "I may be the first woman member of Congress, but I won't be the last." Rankin was dedicated to the causes of women's suffrage and improving social welfare, especially for women and children. She was also a staunch pacifist. She was one of only 50 representatives who voted against the United States' entry into World War I. Her stance cost her politically. After one term in the House, she ran for the Senate but lost. Losing her place in Washington did not slow Rankin down, however. She became the field secretary for the National Consumers League, a post she held for 3 years. Working from the famed Hull House, she traveled around the Midwest speaking for women's rights and workers' rights. She lobbied state legislators to support minimum wage laws and to reduce the long hours required of many workers. She was a major advocate for the Child Labor Amendment. This proposed amendment to the U.S. Constitution would have required Congress to regulate all labor by children under the age of 18. 28 states ratified the amendment, but it never reached approval by 3/4 of the states required to amend the Constitution. In 1941, Rankin returned to Congress. There she continued her dedication to pacifism, where after the attack on Pearl Harbor, she cast the only no vote on the U.S. entry into World War II. The very unpopular vote effectively ended her political career. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, ricksmithshow.com. So yesterday, we had on the program a homeless advocate and my personal friend, Pat LaMarche, talking about the Grants Pass versus Johnson case. And, while there were a lot of nice people saying a lot of nice things and making positive suggestions on what we can do and what we should be doing to end homelessness, wow, some downright mean-spirited and some just angry, almost jealous, if you will. And look, the stereotypical view, the homeless are lazy, unmotivated. They don't want to work. Some said they were responsible for their own situations. They made bad decisions. their poor personal failings, not just economic, but one person actually, it was a moral thing, made it a religious thing. This was God's punishment, which was weird to me, especially given the backdrop of the Easter holiday. Some made the economic issue of, you know, they're a burden on society, draining our resources, and how we should be criminalizing homelessness because they're dangerous. You know, they're criminals. They should be taken away from decent society, which, again, I come back to, could be any one of us at any time. But the main theme that ran through all of the angry, mean-spirited, just downright ridiculous comments, this idea that they should just pull themselves up by their bootstraps. They should just solve their own problems. They don't need help, which I... Wow. And sadly, I mean, you know, their views oversimplify and fail to consider the myriad of complex factors that contribute to this. Healthcare bills, car repairs, which I found, you know, shocking that that is like the number one reason that people give for being homeless. The car broke down, didn't have money to get it fixed, end up losing the job, end up losing the place where you live, got nowhere to go, and now, boom, you are on the streets with no resources. Healthcare right there as well. But, you know, basic economic hardship, money, jobs, this the number one reason people are homeless. Now, look, there are mental illness and substance abuse. There is part of that. But at the end of it, man, it comes down to some simple stuff that we could... If we wanted to, we could help fix. We could create more affordable housing. We could deal with the systemic issues like poverty and mass inequality. We could do some of this. And I guess it's the negative that I spent most of my time focused on, because it's angering to me that we could be so short-sighted until it happens to us. Now, I do want to, you know, tip my hat off to Barbara, who sent me a very long email walking me through her ongoing struggles with homelessness for decades. You know, again, someone who is, you know, working, trying to make ends meet, trying to make that next step, trying to lead a better life, only to have one bit of crisis after another just throw you back. And it's heartbreaking. And we should and could do better. Stacy sent me a nice long email talking about her 5 years of volunteering in downtown San Diego and how things are getting worse. And not only worse in these tent encampments where people are forced to find refuge, but with the people who are doing very well, being angry at the fact that there are people with money in this area that could help. And for me, this is another one of those things where government has to act. One of those reasons that I'm such a big believer in government action. Doing those things collectively that we cannot do individually. I personally cannot end homelessness. Jeff Bezos could. Elon Musk most certainly could. There are billionaires in this country who could, in fact, end this immediately and have a legacy of being that person that ended homelessness. They're not going to, but they could. And this is why we, as a sane civil society of rational voters, could vote for people who say, you know what, we do need more affordable housing. We do need to invest heavily in getting not just homeless people places to stay, but everyone a place to live. Stable housing is a key part of a stable society. And understand, you know, when you have stable housing, you can then deal with all of those other things. You can then have those supportive services like mental health care, substance abuse, job training, all those things. You could then begin that. But first, you got to put a roof over their heads. They got to know where they're going to lay their head at the end of the day. And then we can start talking about all of those other things. And then prevention. Ensuring that, you know what, when you have a $400 car repair, maybe having somewhere where, I don't know, their poor people aren't at the mercy of, I don't know, payday lenders who are going to try and charge them hundreds of percent interest on a short-term loan. Maybe have some way of, oh, I don't know, maybe some religious group could start a car repair service. I don't know, but there's got to be a way forward. And you could probably fund some of that with public dollars on the short term, spending a little bit of money, so that in the long term, you don't have to spend a lot of money. And then you don't have a lot of societal problems. And then we could do all of those other things. Educate, employ. You know, to me, the number one way to ensure that we don't have a homeless population, good union jobs. Give people a job that they can go and earn a decent living and put a roof over there. That sounds like a way forward. But ultimately, this is going to take a long-term commitment. There are no silver bullets. Ending homelessness, long-term commitment, requires sustained commitment, requires resources, and all of us. Again, this is not something that one person generally...
This is locally grown radio.
WFHR 1320 AM, W248 DE Wisconsin Rapids.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.